Welcome to the My Stories podcast, hosted by Michigan Humanities. This podcast shares diverse stories from around Michigan, exploring our uniquely Michigander culture. Now, please enjoy this episode.
All right, it's 7 o'clock on the dot, so we're going to go ahead and get started so that we're respectful of your time this evening. Thank you so much for joining us. I'd like to welcome you to Michigan Humanities' second Why It Matters online conversation. We are joined tonight by people from Washington, D.C., Tennessee, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, California, and of course, both peninsulas of Michigan. Michigan Humanities was the recipient of a grant from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and the Federation of State Humanities Councils to participate in the national Why It Matters Civic and Electoral Participation Initiative. This program will explore civic participation as it relates to electoral engagement in a multivocal democracy. This initiative will take place in 43 states across the country and will conclude in April of this year. Michigan Humanities will present a series of virtual statewide conversations that will examine the electoral process by exploring Michigan's urban-rural divide and the influence of social media and misinformation. These conversations will bring together humanities professionals and Michiganders and folks from all over the country and provide a place for open dialogue and learning. Our next conversation will take place on March 25th at 7 p.m. So please make sure to mark your calendars for that. I'd like to take just a minute to tell you a little bit about Michigan Humanities in case this is your first time with us. Michigan Humanities is one of 56 state humanities councils. We inspire Michiganders to come together in creatively and freely expressed ways to deepen our understanding of ourselves and enrich our communities. In carrying out this mission, Michigan Humanities builds awareness and excitement for humanities in everyday life, achieves best practices and sustainability for all humanities programs and services in Michigan. We provide grant funding to Michigan nonprofits and offer free public humanities programs like the one that you're attending tonight. Michigan Humanities' commitment to dialogue around critical issues and their connection to the humanities is at the center of our programs and grants. We're fortunate to be joined tonight by attendees from across and beyond Michigan and our two special guests, Marcus Collins and Haj Flemings, to learn more about how misinformation has impacted our lives and relationships. So let's go ahead and get started, and I'll introduce our two special guests that you're here to see tonight. Marcus Collins is a culturally curious thinker with an academic insight into the cognitive drivers that impact consumer behavior. Collins is an award-winning advertiser and a lecturer of marketing at the Ross School of Business, University of Michigan, where he helps bridge the academic practitioner gap for both degree-seeking students and business executives. He has spent the last decade helping blue chip brands like McDonald's and Google navigate the challenges of digital transformation to create contagious marketing ideas that extend across both the online and offline worlds of social. Throughout his career, Marcus has been acknowledged for his strategic and creative contributions as an advertiser. He was Advertising Age's 40 Under 40 recipient, Clio Award winner, where he launched such notable campaigns as Cliff Paul for State Farm, the Made in America Music Festival for Budweiser, Hello Brooklyn for the Brooklyn Nets, and the Ego and Netflix's Stranger Things Conquest. So welcome, Marcus. Haj Flemings is the CEO and founder of Brand Camp University and a leading brand strategist, speaker, and tech entrepreneur that travels nationally, inspiring people and brands to build, launch, and grow their ideas. Haj was featured in CNN's Black in America 4, The New Promised Land, Silicon Valley, which was viewed by over 1 million people. The documentary chronicled the journey of Haj and seven other entrepreneurs from around the nation as they lived in Silicon Valley launching their startups. He also founded the Brand Camp Conference in Detroit in 2008 and expanded it to Boston and New York. He recently co-founded Student Ventures to teach middle and high school students about entrepreneurship and technology. His client list includes Walt Disney, Pitney Bowes, Pfizer, the Detroit Lions, the U.S. Department of Defense, Iowa State University, University of Michigan Ross School of Business, Davidson College, University of Detroit, and more. He has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, TechCrunch, Mashable, and CNN Tech Money on the subject of startups, digital technology, and branding. Thank you for being here tonight. And Marcus and Haj, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Haj, good to see you, my man.
Man, it's good to see you, even if it's virtual. It's great
indeed.
To see you.
Indeed. So this is Why It Matters. And, you know, we're talking about information. I guess more accurately, we're talking about misinformation. And considering this is the Michigan Humanities, let's spend this time being as absolutely human as possible. Right. So, you know, the hope is that we can excavate this topic with just a great, great, great sense of empathy and humanity as we talk about this. So sounds good.
Sounds like a plan. Sounds like a plan.
So let's start. Let's start with Rebrand Cities. You are the founder and CEO of Rebrand Cities. Tell us what Rebrand Cities is and how you got into this line of work.
So Rebrand Cities is a global civic design initiative. Our goal is to get 10,000 small businesses that are offline online. Our work started as a project in Detroit called Rebrand Detroit. We started out in a neighborhood. Matter of fact, we had you as one of our instructors. This is back in 2015-ish. And we started getting into this work and we realized it was great to do all these accelerators and work on all of these other great things, but we realized that people didn't even have a website. So they weren't even able to curate their own information and tell their own story. And so that's really where that started. Now we're in 9 cities, 2 countries, and we're excited to work with amazing people.
So why was it so important to get small businesses online? I mean, you talked about curating their information. Say a little bit more about it. Push into that a little bit for me.
Yeah, because small business, especially micro businesses, they are the lifeblood of our economy. Mm-hmm. And so I know it's sexy to talk about the big box brands, the Fortune 100, Fortune 500 companies. But, you know, so when you think about going to a local restaurant or you go to a coffee shop, somebody's put their sweat, blood and tears into developing that. And lots of times they don't have people that sit in certain seats to be able to help them to tell their story because their heads are, you know, it's just because they're head down. There's 20 million small businesses. Right. And so we felt like this is a place where we could like have fun. We could do good and do well at the same time. And that's why we wanted to be able to dig into something that really mattered.
Right. So this idea of curating information says a lot about like getting people online, getting these businesses online wasn't so much just about diverse modality, right? I make commercial impact both in the physical transaction as well as the online transaction. This is about information, right? And because the thing is like, if I don't know about you, how do I know about your products? How do I know where to buy it, what to buy? So having information is very important. But not only that, but small business owners miss out on the information that they can capture about people as well through the zeros and ones, right? How important was that when it comes to Rebrand Cities work about not only being able to be found and heard and hear the stories of these small businesses, but the small businesses to also have information about people?
I think it's important because it's an opportunity where a small business owner can now control the narrative. They can now control their information and they can go direct to consumer. There's never been a greater time in our history where you've been able to connect directly to the end consumer. You see a lot of this in music, right? So now people used to have a record deal and go through these companies that provided all these services. Yeah. Right. And then once you peel the onion back, you're like, I've already built the community. You know, I have the following already. I can go direct to that customer. And so the more information that these small businesses have, the better arm they are at making decisions in terms of where do they put their time at. So now we have everybody lives in an attention economy. Mm-hmm. And so now how do we now take these individuals and show them, okay, all right, you only have so many hours in a day. You only have so many resources. Where should your attention be? Where should you be focused at? And they can take this data to figure out, okay, people are finding them through organic search or find them through IG because they're doing paid ads and that's actually driving the bottom line. Then they can be more intentional in terms of where they direct their information, their time, and their money.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of an artist – that he was singing the hook on a major record that like getting massive airplay, and he was getting record label offers out the wazoo, and he and his management company decided not to sign with the label, but instead use Spotify data to inform what cities they'd go to. So wherever the song was getting played the most geographically, they would book club dates there because they figured that's where fans are. Right. Mm-hmm. And where they weren't getting played a lot, they would run ads there to get in front of new people. Right. So this information about consumers is very, it's empowering. It's not only helping me direct my commercial activity, but also it allows me to have freedom, more control. So as we talk about information, it's probably worthwhile sort of like.
Yeah, I want to dig into this real quick.
Oh, yeah.
Real quick. You know what I'm saying? Because I was talking to a friend of mine who has a distribution center in San Diego, and they work with Live Nation. And so what he was sharing with me is the list of musicians and stuff like that they work with, because like they, you know what I'm saying? Like they ship for the Kardashians and all these different folks. Right. And so 30% of the musical artists who had merch and stuff in there for them to ship, that number had went down 30%, but their growth of sales went up 5x. But here's what happened.
Yeah.
So the Drakes of the world could go in the basement, go drop something in a few hours, and go sell millions or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of merch. And so what was happening is that the brands or the brand name of the artists that people knew, their sales were going through the roof, right? And because they had established a brand, they had the infrastructure set up, they could go create something and push it out. And then they were connected to their customers.
Yeah.
All Drake has to do is just go on the IG, say that this shirt's dropping, and put it in a song, and it's a wrap.
That's right. So the zeros and ones, you talk about digital, right? The technology that generates, processes, and store data in the form of zeros and ones. It is not only it provides information for people to find out about you, right? It allows you to curate your own story, your own information. It also allows the company, these small businesses, these entrepreneurs, to understand the consumer so that they can tailor their offerings accordingly, but also do it with freedom, right? They can have ownership, all very, very, very powerful. But when we talk about information, we're really just talking about facts, right? We're talking about like some representation, details, story that represents truth. Ultimately, information is about a representation of truth, facts. And what we're seeing here is that information, these representations of truth, provides value to consumers and companies, which help local economies thrive.
Yeah. Because I think at the end of the day, so if you think about the psychology of how people think and they buy products, like, so logic is one part of it, but people love stories, right? And so if we go into storytelling, we can go back to the hero's journey, Joseph Campbell, 1949, like all of these things in terms of getting people to make decisions that's not based totally on utility.
Yes.
And so what happened is that like if there's certain products that I buy, like I'm drawn in by the story or the backstory of kind of how that company was formed.
Yeah.
And some of this stuff is true. Some of this stuff is made up. I don't know how much of the Häagen-Dazs story is authentic. I don't know how much of the Fiji water untouched by humans is like, but the average person is like, when's the last time I have been to Fiji? I've never been to Fiji, so the story must be true, and it sounds like it's an exotic spot that I've never been to, you know. And so we buy into these stories because we want to believe the story.
I mean, mythology is so powerful that way, right? We buy into the myths. And you know, culturally speaking, this, we use stories as humans to help socialize cultural characteristics, right? What we value, what's expected of us as members of the community, right? Stories are a way by which we do that. I mean, this is how we get folklore, is how we get urban legends, is how religion is taught through stories, right? Mm-hmm. And this idea, and I like the way you push this, like, is it true or not? I don't know, but I buy into the story. I mean, I often remember the Coca-Cola story that Coca-Cola created Santa Claus, right? Like that's the story. Okay. Apparently that's not true, but like they were a part of like the carnation, a more recent incarnation of Santa Claus, but the concept of Santa Claus, Saint Nick, was not Coca-Cola, but that's the mythology that is told, which gets me wondering here, if information at its core is about the representation of truth, what exactly is misinformation? So like misinformation, one would think is just the opposite of information, right? I mean, we hear about misinformation, data privacy, misuse of information, conspiracy theories and the like. Is information getting a bad rep here? Like, is it
so
all?
I mean, the
mythology of Fiji is not hurting anybody, right? Is that really bad that we think about these mythologies with Coca-Cola and Santa Claus? Is that really should it be lumped into misuse of information like data privacy or misinformation like conspiracy theories? Should we be having more demarcation about information and misinformation?
Well, I think, you know, so fake news, misinformation. So none of this stuff is new, right? So we've had tabloids. And so I remember going to the grocery store, walking through the line, and then you see these tabloids and they say alien has come and looked at all this other kind of stuff. We know 90% of the stuff in there is not true, but we still pick the magazine up because we're intrigued and enthralled about the story. Or if you start thinking about the history of propaganda, and if you go back to Edward Bernays and Torches of Freedom and all of these things. So now you create a story that people can buy into. And it's like, so it's almost like when we were kids, and you would tell somebody something. And by the time it got back to you, and I don't know if that's called the phone story or whatever it's called, but by the time that story got back to you, it was 180 degrees different. And everybody communicated what they thought they heard.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, it's a telephone game. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. I mean, none of this is new. None of it is new, right? Fake news, I call it gossip, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and the thing about gossip by itself seems to have, you know, these negative implications, right? These implications that gossip is negative. There's actually some positive to gossip, right? Like, mm-hmm. Gossip helps us self-regulate without any authority. Mm-hmm. Right? You're like, oh, did you hear what happened to Jennifer? No, what happened with Jennifer? Dude, let me tell you. And as I tell you this story about what happened with Jennifer, you now know what not to do, right? You know what is socially acceptable. And then you also know that if you go against those social rules, then you're going to be talked about like Jennifer. And now you know how to govern, right? Allows to self-govern without an authoritative figure. So one would say then, in this case, false information, which mm-hmm. is, you know, not facts. mm-hmm. It has some use to it. When do we cross the line? Again, are there multiple demarcations of what information and misinformation is, or this is a continuum where we get too far on one polar side, then now we're in the danger zone?
So I've seen people use it in ways to where like it's fun and it's a way where it gets you away from dealing with the challenges of life. So it could be reality TV, and there are extremes as it relates back to, you know what I'm saying, like reality, like, you know, like TV. And so it'd be certain things where you're like, well, I mean, that's cool, even though you know it's not true, right?
Yeah.
But then you go and you look at the political situation where, like in 2016, it kind of gets like amplified. And I know Trump, like, I think he tried to take credit for, you know, for the term fake news. I don't think he quite created it. No. But you know what I'm saying? But the thing is that then you look at the political side and they go to the extreme and it makes you just hate all the misinformation, because I hate political ads. Like, they're just no fun to watch, right? And so you have like these extremes to where it's interesting, because I think the thing that happened is that I was reading something that said like false stories spread faster than the truth.
Yes, right.
And so it's interesting because that means that, so is it, So is it that like we're intrigued by it? And there's another term that I'm forgetting, but it was in a conversation I had with Hill Harper, and he was saying to where like, so media outlets will say, we're going to, you know, play this or have more of this content because this is what people want. But it's not really that. What ends up happening is that the more you give people of something, then they're going to want more of whatever that thing is. And I can't remember the term, but there's a term for that.
It's sort of feeding the media.
A gift and good. A gift and good is what it's called. A gift and good.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, and I like what you're getting here. Where you talk about like politics, because how can we not talk about politics, right? Fake news, while it's not a new idea, it definitely was coined in the Trump years. And the thing about like misinformation is that the mis part, like that prefix mis, makes us think that it's the opposite of information. There is information and then like misinformation. So if information is the factual representation of truth, right? It is representation of truth. Then misinformation must be false, right? It's the inaccurate representation of truth. But if you look at the definition of misinformation, they say misinformation is not only falsehoods, but there's this slant that connotes a deliberate intent to deceive. And now this gets me going here. A deliberate intent to deceive. So this is, we're talking about here, this is a matter of intentionality. So it's not just that the information is wrong or the information is false. This is really about whether my intentions are nefarious or not, which is difficult to sort of identify, say for like some explicit expression that I am doing this to, you know, to hurt people. We say for that, how do we know what people's intentions are? That is, how do we evaluate what is false information and what is misinformation?
And there's so many blurring. So the line is really getting blurred. And it's blurred in many cases on purpose. So let's look at influencer marketing, right? Mm-hmm. So you have somebody wearing a product, and so are they getting paid to wear it? So the brand wants you to feel like this is just what they wear. Yeah. So I remember seeing an ad. It was I think LeBron James. It was a Kia ad and it had LeBron James in it. I was like,
stop. LeBron, you ain't driving that car. Come
You're
on,
you're not LeBron. Driving. The only time you drive this car is in this ad. That's the only exactly. time you're driving it. When this ad is over, you are not driving the Kia. And I'm not knocking Kia at all. I'm just saying that at that level, when you're like a billionaire athlete, you're not driving the Kia. It's just not happening. Like you're just not. So I think there's more of those kind of blurring lines too that also happen.
Yeah, I mean, so how do we evaluate it then? Like, if it's only way I can know if your intentions are good is to sort of be in your head, or you explicitly tell me I'm doing this for these reasons and I believe that that is truthful. How do we demarcate? How do we identify what is false information that is not the truth? And what is misinformation? That is, what is false information with the intentionality to deceive?
So I think part of it is that we're part of the system and we're part of the problem, right? So, and I even do this, and I even, you know, so now, every time we share something, like something, comment on something, how often have we shared, commented, or like something, and we read the headline, we read some of it, but didn't read all of it. And so it's like, because I'm tied up, because we're pulled in so many different directions, I'm like, okay, I read part of it, I think this is good, and we might have got to a point to where, and so sometimes we do it inadvertently, right?
Yeah.
And so I think now there's so much stuff that's coming because now everybody's the media, and we got to break the information. So I just saw this come across my feed. Okay, I want to post it before somebody else does. This seems like it's right. I think it came from a good source, and we just post. And maybe 75% of the time we're cool, but there's a certain portion I'm sure that we push, and we, you know, it's not done on purpose to try to deceive somebody, but it's like I didn't really do the due diligence. Back when I was younger, we had to memorize phone numbers. I knew everybody's phone number that I called. I know my wife's phone number and my mother's, and that's it. because I can search. But like, so the way we consume and process information is just different.
And I mean, I think you're right. I think that's what makes this idea of misinformation such a challenging one, because false information, again, is falsehood, what is not fact. Misinformation becomes a character attack. And mm-hmm. when you accuse someone of engaging in misinformation, fake news, you know, the thing is then now I'm saying that you are a bad person, right? You're nefarious. And truthfully, that becomes an ethical issue. As you start to attack my character, not what I say and do, it goes through a different rubric by which I respond, which is why I think there's so much polarity when it comes to different ways of living, different political affiliations, different cultural subscriptions, right? All of these things are at play here. And this is where things get really scary. They get really, really scary because we're talking about information in media, like intentionality, information, like information is like terribly influential, right? We're talking about the psychology of information is very, very influential. There is the mere exposure effect, or it's the more we see it, the more we prefer it, right? The more we see a thing, the more we like it. There is not only the more we see it, the more we like it, the more we believe it to be true, right? And then, especially when it comes from our people, like if I see you post something and I only read the headline, I'm like, well, it must mean this. It must be real because Hodge wouldn't lie.
Yeah. And you know what? You bring up a very good point. And so I do that quite often. So like if I know that, you know, so I'm like, Mark is a vetted source, right? So
right.
It's like CNN. It's like, okay, all right. So I know he's not throwing garbage up there. I know I don't have to, you know, he's a family man. He's all these other you know, sort of certain things. Brands are shortcuts, as we all know, right? So
right. So
I know that if you're posting it, I'm probably not going to have to worry about whether this is a family-friendly kind of thing or anything, you know what I'm saying? So there's certain shortcuts that we automatically associate like with people. And so we all do it, right? And so it does allow us to be able to share content and to feel free. Are we going to take a hit sometimes? Absolutely. Because there's just going to be some stuff we're like, oh, if I'd have read that. And then you just take it down, right? Or you have to shift. And so I do think it's interesting. I was reading something else that said 35% of people believe that the news on TV is misinformation. And then they said they also believe that 65% of people believe that news on social media was also misinformation. And the thing that I find interesting is that where do we get our news? I get a lot of my news from social media. So like stuff that breaks, like if somebody passed away or what's ever happening in technology, like I'm going to Twitter, I'm going to TechCrunch. If I'm looking for fashion stuff, I'm going to IG.
Hold on one
second. Yep.
Love you, baby. Can I?
Hey.
Coworkers.
A new part of the world, right?
Yeah.
So, you know what I'm saying? So all of these things are like, you know, because now since we're all the media, the sources that we look to for information are different than they were 10 years ago.
And that's what I think is the important part here, that because we are media producers and the conduit for the dissemination of information more than we've ever been before, thanks to the technology that we consume, then we are judging the information or evaluating the information as information, false information, or misinformation. We're judging people, or it's implicitly in judging people. And I think that's where the challenges are happening here. I think when we say fake news, we're not talking about the content. It's like I'm pointing at you, saying that you're acting in a way that is not cool, right?
Yeah.
That you are deceiving people purposefully, which begs the question then, who's at fault? Like who's at fault? People who gives birth to the misinformation or the people who delivers it, right? Whose responsibility is it? Like what do we do?
So I think, you know what I'm saying? So pre-internet, so the internet's been around like a little over 30 years, right? So, so pre-internet, when information passed, it passed from person to person, and the ability to be able to spread an idea, it didn't move as fast as it does now in the digital economy.
Yeah, the social revolution.
It is, yeah. Yeah. And so the social web has changed literally everything. So now information, so something that might have taken weeks or years to be able to kind of spread can literally spread in 5 minutes. And so now, all depending on the platform, you could have somebody who is a contributor to Fast Company, and they write an article, and somebody's like, oh, this is a Fast Company article. Well, no, it didn't go through the same level of editorial proofing, but it's on the Fast Company platform.
It bears the mark of Fast Company, yes. Therefore has the credence of Fast Company.
Yes. And so now we're taking these as like gospel. This is truth. And now Fast Company is behind this. And so the idea that, you know, so they're trying to give more voice to more people for ideas to spread. The challenge with that is that you're not going through the same vetting system.
Yeah.
And so then people have ulterior motives. Some people want the, you know, let me give you an example. So I'm a sneakerhead, and I know you are too. So the story broke about Ann Herbert, who was a VP at Nike, her son, 19 years old, West Coast Joe. Like, dude, you're living the dream. You obviously have insider information. But what was important to him? He was clout chasing. I don't care what anybody says. And I think his mother knew, you know, enough. But like, stay below the radar. And, you know what I'm saying? So it's stories like that where they'll take something and they just go run with it. And now they go turn it into something else because of clout. And so sometimes I think people are looking for, like, look at me. This is my opportunity to be able to shine. And they use this in a way that's probably not that good.
Yeah, you know, so I think about, and when I think about that question about whose responsibility is it, you know, I think it's all of our responsibility. I think it's our responsibility as media producers to do our fact checking, which, I mean, that's like, you know, quintessential journalism, right? Like the fact checking. But it's our responsibility also as the disseminators of media, i.e. when I share an article that I read, well, first that I read it, then just read the headline, but also to like provide some context to it as well. Like, you know, we'll sort of like balloon things out there that we either didn't read or we don't have a real opinion on, so we just sort of share it. And there's an implied opinion there, but we don't say anything. We don't provide any context. I think it's also the responsibility of us as community members when we check people who disseminate information that is false, that we don't go directly to it being misinformation. In my opinion, I think we give everybody the benefit of the doubt that everyone means well, but let me kind of inform you what's going on. It's like, we do it in love, right? It's how we say in church. Like,
yes.
Let me check you in love. I'm only telling you this. I'm reproving you because I love you, but let me check you on this, right? That's like the human thing to do. But while that's happening, we also have to be able to call a spade when we see like conspiracy theories.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think part of the problem is that we live in echo chambers. And so what happens is that we tend to follow people who have the same ideology or thought process that we do. And there's nothing wrong with following people who have a similar value system, but we very rarely follow people who have a different worldview than we do. And I think we need to expand our circle. And sure. So to start to listen to other voices, we might not agree, but I would only do it with people that I respect, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. But I think that, so without doing that, it's the same stuff. And we typically want to reinforce the fact that we're right or stuff that we believe. And I think that's another part of the challenge.
And I mean, I think I agree with the social networking platforms, social networking platforms that we engage in, there are echo chambers, but they're only echo chambers because our lives are echo chambers. Like, even outside of Facebook, our closest friends see the world the way we do. They believe what we believe. They're probably in the same similar socioeconomic status as we are. You know, they probably subscribe or are party within the same sexual orientation. Like, it's just natural. It's human for us. I mean, it's like psychology referred to as homophily, that we like people like us, like self-loving homophily, right? We connect to people who are like ourselves. It's just who we are, right? Like, if you're traveling internationally and you heard nothing but foreign accents, and then you hear American accent, you go, American, where are you from? I'm from Chicago. Oh my God, I'm from Detroit, Midwest, holla, what's going on? Like, what are you doing? Let's hang out, right? We connect to people who are like ourselves. So like that part, I'm with you. And I think it would be good to widen our aperture. But I also think that we have to be more human in the way that we address these things as individuals, right? Like, there's family members, you know, what did I say at Thanksgiving dinner? You would talk about religion, money, or politics because of how divisive they are, right?
Yeah,
because they imply, or they are manifestations of ideologies that we have. And once we start talking about politics, religion, or money, we start to realize how disaligned we are ideologically. And therefore we go, whoa, wait a minute. And so therefore we typically don't talk about it. Or if someone doesn't share the same worldview as we do, we go unfollow, unfriend. And I think that if we are to sort of close the gap or tighten the bonds within our communities, our social networks, then we just got to be better at the way that we enter the discourse about these differences, or rather how we correct those who are disseminating false information, and that is doing it without the judgment that what you are doing is intentional. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think we have to have more tolerance too, because like one side will say, well, like, I'm tolerant, but they really aren't, because if you don't say stuff that agrees with what they do or they believe, then, you know, it's like you're the worst person in the world. So I think we have to have more tolerance. And also, too, we have to have the, you know, one thing I've learned through this pandemic is that how important humanity is, mm-hmm. and how important we are for each other. And even people that don't look like me or look like you, or talk the way we do. Like, I realized after being at home by myself, you know, to be with my family, who, you know, I have an amazing family. But like the regular interaction that we would have at the coffee shop or going to the gym with the people that we don't see on a regular basis, those are the parts of our lives that were snatched away.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important to be able to, like, there's so much I learned from my daughter who's 10, or I learned from somebody who is different than me just from observation. And what I try to do is I try to take the perspective of not reading my own press clipping, because there's a whole nother level out there that I think that, you know, that I would like to get to. But like, I can watch somebody and say, you know, I don't think I totally agree with everything that they do, but like, but what are the good aspects of what they say? Or if somebody says something to me or you and they say it in the wrong way, can we take the good of what they are saying, even though maybe they didn't communicate it in the right way, or they went too far to the left.
And you know, I agree with that. And as I say that, you know, if I'm being introspective, even that sits on a spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, like, when I hear information that is just false, I'm like, that is not what he said, or that is exactly what he said. What you're saying is false, actually. My first instinct is not to say you're a bad person or that you're crazy, right? Mm-hmm. Without knowing your intent, because intentionality to me is where the demarcation happens between information, false information, and misinformation. Mm-hmm. When we're in the realm of misinformation, where your actions are overtly telling me sort of your intention, that's when the bonds begin to break, right? So if your worldview requires my marginalization, requires my suffering, requires the brutality to my body, to my life being insignificant, now there's a gulf between us, that this isn't about it's not even the information anymore. It's a manner of worldview. It's a matter of how we see ourselves in this world. And to me, I think that's as we talk about this, that's sort of where the separation is happening to me, is that we evaluate the information as a proxy to evaluate each other.
Yeah. And I think, like, to your point too,
I think that we have to separate them, that look, this information is false, but you're a good person. Mm-hmm. Until it is demonstratively manifested or expressed that, oh, this information is false because you are a bad person.
Mm-hmm. And I think, like, to your point, so there's a guy, and I can't pronounce his last name, but his first name is Chamath. And he runs something called Social Capital. And he's like a billionaire many times over. And so one of the things that he talks about wealth being a force. And so he said, when you're at a certain point from an economic standpoint, now your worldview gets put into the earth and people now listen to it. Mm. And so I think it's interesting because we put certain worldview, a certain perspective, we give more credence to it based upon social class. And so you start getting into the one percenters, upper class, other kind of stuff. And so what happened is that, you know, that Jeff Bezos worldview or Bill Gates, who's the largest landowner now. So now I'm wondering about the food and all the other kind of stuff. Right. So, but I say all that to say, so now, but somebody like that has a platform, the media wants to hear from them. They have all of these outlets to be able to get their ideas out there. Bill Gates talked about the coronavirus like 5 years ago, like at a TED conference. Like it was, you know, like, I mean, so I say all that to say, so now his view of the world, we all know it. And then there's other views that we don't give as much play to because they're not as quote unquote powerful.
And that, I mean, I think that is why the people who are in the privileged position, whether it's because of socioeconomic status, whether it's because you are a political figure, i.e. you hold a political place in society, in your state, in your city, or your local municipality, right? Or you are a celebrity, we had to be very judicious about how you produce media, mm-hmm. the information that you propagate, because people are listening. Likewise, media properties, be it these individuals or media vehicles like publishers and the like, have to give voice to those who are voiceless. If there is to be a balance, right?
Yeah. And then you have the Jeff Bezos of the world. He owns the Washington Post. So now, is there a conflict of interest? So now, I mean, and I love to be Jeff Bezos, you know, in terms of what he's created, right? But if you think about a person owning a media platform like the Washington Post, where you can kind of control certain narratives, that does become a very interesting proposition.
I mean, isn't that politics though? Right? If you have a large disposable income, i.e. you're quite wealthy, you donate money to politicians, to lobbyists, etc., which work to get your worldview into practice, right? Like, so what we're seeing here is that this idea of misinformation isn't just fact or false. It's so much more than that. It's about intentionality, which is a judgment call on people, and we're evaluating information beyond binary correct or incorrect. But we're doing this as a proxy to evaluate people, which says then, as you think about rebrand cities, you're trying to bridge the digi divide with these small businesses and cities. Is there a geographical divide here as well? Like, should we be rebranding rural areas also? Rebrand cities and rebrand rural areas also, because these worldviews are quite different, and the stories that are being mythologized between these people, being propagated between these different sects of people, are fortifying these worldviews that may be harmful, but also may marginalize other communities.
Yeah. So digital divide is a global issue. It's So, you know, so the same issue that we have in the, well, I'm not going to say the same, but issues that we have in Detroit or in urban cities are similar issues that we have in rural cities. There's a lack of access, strong Wi-Fi in communities. And so what's happening is that now you have students who are not able to have access to the same learning opportunities. So I'll give you an example. So we'll work with the city of Los Angeles, and that's not rural. But, you know, so when the lockdown happened and they were like, we have to make sure every single family has a device for their, you know what I'm saying, for their child to be able to go to school. What about the families that have three kids going to three different schools and they don't have, or they don't have internet or it's not that strong, and you're given one device? Now, what do you do? So now you start seeing this stuff is happening in rural communities.
Yeah.
It's happening. So in affluent communities, we don't see this, but the rural communities are dealing with some of the same challenges that urban cities are. So.
Yeah, but the stories that are being told are different in these communities. So, dude, so I feel like, you know, like we need to be rebranding, just like we're rebranding cities in different ways, particularly with small businesses. If I think we need a rebranding of rural communities, at least the stories that are told in these communities, or the stories are told about them. Because based on my media diet, at least, the stories I'm told is that people see me a certain way. A black male from Detroit, Michigan, went to public schools my entire life. I must be X, Y, and Z, right? That is what the exit polls tell me. That is what media consumption, Fox News is telling me. Like, that's what I'm being told of who I am. At least that's how these people see me. And if that's not the case, then we should be telling better stories about these rural areas, right? Like, we should be rebranding these rural areas also.
Yeah. And I think too, part of it is that we definitely have to take ownership. So what I try to do is, like, so after the George Floyd situation and all those stuff started happening, I started sharing people some of my own stories that I have to deal with. So when I'm going into a parking lot and it's late at night, and I'm walking in there and there's a young lady who's walking down the stairs and I'm in Birmingham, Michigan, I slow down because in the back of her mind, it doesn't mean that she thinks I'm a bad person, but, you know, but the media has done a tremendous job of creating a certain public view of what a black male or black man is and all these other kind of things. So then I have to then account for the fact that, okay, what if she feels this way? And even if I wasn't black, just being a man and being late and being That's in right. proximity is an issue, right? And so That's all right. of these things. So in my mind, I'm playing through 1,000 different scenarios. Another case. So when I go to the Apple store, so, you know, I went there, I bought something. It's a pre-COVID-19. And they're like, well, you don't need a bag. I said, look, I'm African-American. I want the bag. I want the receipt. Email it to me. I want the hard copy of the receipt.
That's right.
I want a couple bags. And she didn't understand. And so then I had to kind of break down to her. I said, I don't walk around the mall without a bag and without a receipt.
That's right.
I don't want to have to fumble through my phone to figure out, hey, look, I want the physical one and all the other kind of stuff just based on my personal life experience.
And because of the stories that are told about people who look like you and me.
Yes.
Now, and this I think is sort of like, because I know we're coming to the end of our time here. This is what I think is sort of the takeaway, at least for me. This is what I've gleaned here is that those stories are not true. It's not a true story. That narrative, that information is not true about who you are or who I am. Mm-hmm. But that is a story that woman or whomever this, you know, fictitious person is, have been told. And therefore, her worldview is that that's who you are, and she responds accordingly. Now, do we judge her or do we judge the information? And I would, and my take would be, the first thing we do is separate the two, that she is trying to protect herself. And it's informed by this information that she's gotten that is not accurate. However, it's still wrong.
That is very, very powerful, right? Because at the end of the day, it's like we're socialized a certain way. We have unconscious bias. And so our unconscious is making decisions and, you know, and processing content based on history and all these other kind of things. So in a moment, we're making these split decisions. And so it comes from the stuff that we've been exposed to. And
right.
lots of times, so that's why as parents, that's why the nuclear family is so important, because we are forming, they're not kids, like these little people, to be able to help them. So when they get in these situations, what kind of decisions do they make? How do they treat people?
That's right. That's right. We are helping, we're helping shape and frame their worldview. So if anything, I think the takeaway from me is this, from our conversation is this, at least this is what's sheared up in my mind, that information is fact. False information is inaccurate, right? It's not the truth. Misinformation is false information, but with intention to deceive. Mm-hmm. And what, regardless of if it's false information or misinformation, it is wrong. It's mm-hmm. false. And that needs to be rectified, right? That means we need better stories. We need better information. But to approach this with humanity, at least in my head, is to first separate the information from the person. Let's take care of the information. This is wrong. Let me correct you. And then let's talk about you. Not talk about you. Let's understand why you believe what you believe. And if your belief system is only informed by the information you've received, well, oh, well, let me help you out. let me rectify this for you. Let me shine some light in the situation so now you have truth. But if your adoption of this belief system is because your worldview is such that, you know, all Black people are inferior or are violent, or, you know, Muslims are inherently terrorist, or Hispanic people, they don't want to work, or whatever these horrible, disgusting stereotypes that we have about people that we use to sort of guide our behavior on a day-to-day basis. If your false information is grounded and supported because that is your worldview, now we have an issue with you.
And yes. Those
are the things that need to be rectified. First, the information, then the you.
Mm-hmm. And then I think as individuals, at the end of the day, we have to figure out, okay, what do we have to do so that we safeguard ourselves? So mm-hmm. if you're affluent, you have lawyers and, you know, we have this and all kind of stuff that you have in place, you know, like, you know what I'm saying? Like we work with people that we don't trust, but we have tools called contracts and all these other things to protect. Like, so if you have resources, you're able to kind of shield yourself from some of these other things. Some people are in a position to where they don't have all those resources. So trying to figure out how you safeguard yourself and your family is really important. And we have to take ownership of that part.
Yeah. I think we have to tell better stories, man. We have to tell better stories, and we need to reproof with love.
Yes.
It's like, you know, Haj, I love you. I know you meant well.
But don't ever do that again.
What is wrong? What you said is absolutely wrong. It is factually inaccurate. But if we do that and then you go, no, this is why it's true because of these underlying issues. Now we got to do work on the person. I love this, man. I'm glad we did this, man. I feel like we didn't have enough time to really, really, really dig in, man. But at least I walked away with a firmer perspective, a firmer point of view. I kind of walked in with like a lot of like ideas that sort of didn't really gel, but this helped firm up a point of view that I can walk away with. And hopefully to all the folks who've joined us today from across the country, hopefully this firmed you up a little bit as well.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And you both, I was kind of checking off the questions, you know, that we got in registration and that people were putting in the chat. You guys were answering them before. So it was great. I just kind of crossed them off my list. One question that has kind of come up over all of these conversations is, you know, we've talked a lot about as adults, how do we approach friends and family? How do we kind of deal with this misinformation? How do we use our resources? But let's talk for a second about media literacy with our kids and teenagers. And, you know, is this something that we should be looking at, you know, as a curriculum in schools? Like, what kind of skills as parents? I know I have two teenagers, you know, what kind of literacy, you know, best practices can we be showing our kids right now so that this polarization doesn't continue to happen?
You know, it's a challenge, especially, you know, so I have a 6-year-old and a 21-month-old. And, you know, we're all living together every single day in this COVID world. So while my wife and I are watching MSNBC, then flicking over to Fox to see what they're saying about it, then see what CNN says about it, my 6-year-old is observing that. She's digesting that information as well. And we'll hear her say something, you know, that like me and my wife and I were not arguing about, but we're like, those people crazy over there. How can they do X, Y, and Z? And she'll like repeat that back to us, like, they're crazy, huh, Dad? And I go, whoa, wait a minute, right? Just like we're talking about social networking platforms, I'm now a media producer for her. So a part of this is not keeping her from it, because I don't think that helps, right? But having some discernment and provide some discernment in her to be able to evaluate good and bad, right? Based upon the world that we're trying to shape for her, but also providing perspective for her. Even if, like, say, we don't see it this way, but people see it this way. So she understands the worldview that other people have and can think about evaluating the worldview as opposed to the people, evaluating the information as opposed to the people themselves, so that hopefully she could be much more empathetic. And considering the ubiquity or the pervasiveness, rather, of the media that we're digesting every single day, multiple times a day, there has to be greater savvy for us as users. To your point, this needs to be a part of the curriculum for at least for high school, while you're starting to kind of develop your own ideas, not those just straight from your parents.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know what I'm saying? Just to add on to that, I think kids are being groomed, right? So we all, I have a daughter who's 10 years old. So we're all dealing with, okay, trying to keep them off devices as much as possible, which is a challenge when you're working and doing other kind of stuff, right? And so they start looking at YouTube, start looking at these other things to where they become consumers. And so they don't see all of the other things. And so when they then get exposed to news, it's like, oh, it's got to be true because it's in YouTube or something like that. And so then you get into that level of things that we have to kind of deal with it.
Yeah. Well, I saw in the newspaper, I saw the Inquirer.
It was in print, it's real.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. The moon landing was a hoax, or, you know, yeah, this baby, this person gave birth to a bat. I saw the picture of it.
It's a real bat. No, that was photoshopped in there.
Bat boy, right? Remember, that was always in the newspaper, the grocery store.
Yeah, or it happened on TikTok, so it's got to be real.
It's got to be real. I saw it on Facebook. Yeah. It's got to be real. And the thing is, you know, discernment, being able to identify what is fact and what is fiction. And that's something that we all have to get better at. But I think that even as important as discerning the binary factor fiction is about how do we factor in humanity. We evaluate what's real and what's not real first, without the perceived implication that these people are bad people. Yeah. Until they demonstrate themselves as such, then that's another story. then you get treated the way you're supposed to be treated at that
point. Well, great. Thank you so much, Marcus and Haj, for being with us tonight. Thank you to all of you for being with us. This eventually will be on our website as a recorded webinar. We also will be recording a podcast. So the audio from tonight will be taken and then included with a debrief conversation that the three of us are going to have. And then those all will be published as podcasts as part of this project as well. So if you have friends or family that you think would benefit from hearing this conversation tonight, we'll have multiple ways for you to share that with them. Our next conversation is coming up on March 25th with Dr. Jason Dibble and Dr. Donegal Young, and we'll be talking to them about, again, the psychology of misinformation and talking more about how can we bridge that gap with friends and families that we have relationships with that are really feeling the effect of the polarization that has kind of, you know, been an epidemic for us as a society. Again, thank you so much, Marcus, Haj, for being with us tonight. Thank you to all of you. Stay well, stay safe, and we'll see you again soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the My Stories podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast streaming service so that you can be alerted when new episodes are released. Follow Michigan Humanities on Facebook and Instagram for exciting news on what's going on in our state. See you next time.